Mr. Borden gave me an envelope. It had a check in it for a year's salary. That was pretty generous, giving you a year's salary, considering you hadn't even worked there a full year and you had said you were quitting, don't you think? Freeman objected on relevance, and it was sustained. I have nothing further for this witness. Freeman took my place, arriving at the lectern with her trusty file, which she spread open. I had not put Driscoll on my witness list until that morning, but his name had come up during Friday's testimony. I was sure Freeman had done some prep work. I was about to find out how much. Mr. Driscoll, you don't have a college degree, do you?
No.
But you attended UCLA, did you not?
Yes.
Why didn't you graduate? I stood and objected, saying her questions were going way outside the scope of Driscoll's direct testimony. But the judge said I opened the door when I asked the witness about his credentials and experience in IT. He told Driscoll to answer the question.
I didn't graduate because I was expelled.
For what?
Cheating. I hacked into a teacher's computer and downloaded an exam the night before it was given.
Driscoll said it with an almost bored tone to his voice, like he knew this was going to come out. I knew this was in his background. I told him that if it came out, he had only one choice, to be absolutely honest. Otherwise, he would be inviting disaster.
So, you were a cheater and a thief, correct?
I was, and that was more than 10 years ago. I don't cheat anymore. There's nothing to cheat for.
Really? And what about stealing?
Same thing. I don't steal.
Isn't it true that your employment at a loft was severed abruptly when it was discovered that you were systematically stealing from the company?
That is a lie. I told them I was quitting, and then they canned me.
Aren't you the one who is lying here?
No, I'm telling the truth. You think I could just make this stuff up? Driscoll made a desperate glance toward me, and I wished he hadn't. It could be interpreted as collusion between us. Driscoll was on his own up there. I couldn't help him.
As a matter of fact, I do, Mr. Driscoll, Freeman said. Isn't it true that you had quite a little business for yourself running out of a loft?
No. Driscoll demonstrably shook his head in support of his denial. I read him as lying right there, and I realized I was in deep trouble. The severance package, I thought. The year's pay. They don't fire people and give them a year's pay if they've been stealing. Bring up the severance package.
Were you not using a loft as a front to order expensive software, then break the security codes and sell bootleg copies over the internet?
That's not true. I knew this would happen if I told anyone what I know. This time, he did more than look at me. He pointed at me.
I told you this would happen. I told you these people don't...
Mr. Driscoll, the judge boomed. You answer the question posed to you by counsel. You do not talk to defense counsel or anyone else.
Trying to keep her momentum, Freeman swooped in for the kill.
Your Honor, may I approach the witness with a document?
You may. Are you going to mark it?
People's Exhibit 9, Your Honor.
She had copies for everybody. I leaned close to Aronson so we could read it together. It was a copy of an internal investigation report from a loft.
Did you know about any of this? Aronson whispered.
Of course not, I whispered back. I leaned forward to focus on the examination. I didn't want a first-year lawyer tisk-tisking me over a gigantic vetting failure.
What is that document, Mr. Driscoll? Freeman asked.
I don't know, the witness responded. I've never seen it before.
It is an internal investigation summary from a loft, isn't it?
If you say so.
When is it dated?
February 1st.
That was your last day of work at a loft, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
That morning, I gave my supervisor 2 weeks' notice, and then they erased my login and fired me.
For cause.
For no cause. Why do you think they gave me the big check at the door? I knew things, and they were trying to shut me up.
Freeman looked up at the judge.
Your Honor, could you instruct the witness to refrain from answering my questions with his own questions?
Perry nodded. The witness will answer questions, not pose them. It didn't matter, I thought. He had gotten it out there.
Mr. Driscoll, could you please read the paragraph of the report I have highlighted in yellow?
I objected, stating that the report was not in evidence. The judge overruled, allowing the reading to proceed, subject to a later evidentiary ruling. Driscoll read the paragraph to himself and then shook his head.
Out loud, Mr. Driscoll, the judge prompted.
But this is all complete lies. This is what they do to...
Mr. Driscoll, the judge intoned grumpily. Read the paragraph aloud, please.
Driscoll hesitated one last time and then finally read.
The employee admitted that he had purchased the software packages with a company requisition and then returned them after copying the copyrighted materials. The employee admitted he has been selling counterfeit copies of the software over the internet using company computers to facilitate this business. The employee admitted earning more than $100,000.
Driscoll suddenly crushed the document with both hands into a ball and threw it across the courtroom. Right at me.
You did this!
He yelled at me, following his pitch with a pointed finger.
I was fine in the world till you showed up!
Once again, Judge Perry could have used a gavel. He called for order and for the jury to return to the deliberations room. They quickly filed out of the courtroom, as if being chased by Driscoll himself. Once the door was closed, the judge took further action, signaling the courtroom deputy forward.
Jimmy, take the witness to the holding cell, while counsel and I discuss this in chambers.
He got up and stepped off the bench and quickly slipped through the door to his chambers, before I could mount a protest over how my witness was being treated. Freeman followed, and I detoured to the witness stand.
Just go, and I'll get this over. You'll be right back out.
You fucking liar,
he said, anger jumping in his eyes.
You said it would be easy and safe, and now look at this. The whole world thinks I'm a fucking software thief. You think I'll ever find work again?
Well, if I had known you were hijacking software, I probably wouldn't have put you on the stand.
Fuck you, Holler. You better hope this is over, because if I have to come back here, I'm gonna make up some shit about you.
The deputy was leading him toward the door that led to the holding cell next to the courtroom. As he went, I noticed Aronson standing at the defense table. Her face told the story. All her good work of the morning, possibly undone.
Mr. Holler, the court clerk said from her corral, the judge is waiting.
Yeah, I said. I'm coming. I headed toward the door. Chapter 47. Four Green Fields was always dead on Monday nights. It was a bar that catered to the legal crowd, and it usually wasn't until a few days into the week that lawyers started to need alcohol to dampen the burdens of conscience. We could have had our pick of the place, but we took to the bar, Aronson sitting between me and Cisco. We ordered a beer, a Cosmo, and a vodka tonic with lime, and without the vodka. Still smarting from the Donald Driscoll fiasco, I had called the after-hours meeting to talk about Tuesday, and because I thought my two associates could use a drink. There was a basketball game on the TV, but I didn't even bother to check who was playing or what the score was. I didn't care, and couldn't see much further than the Driscoll disaster. His testimony had ended after the blow-up and finger-pointing. In chambers, the judge had worked out a curative address to the jurors, telling them that both the prosecution and defense had agreed that he would be dismissed from giving further testimony. Driscoll, at best, had been a wash. His direct testimony certainly set up the defense contention that Louis Aparicio had brought about the demise of Mitchell Bondurant. But his credibility had been undermined during cross-examination, and his volatile behavior and enmity toward me didn't help. Plus, the judge was obviously holding me responsible for the spectacle, and that would probably end up hurting the defense. So, Aronson said after her first sip of Cosmo, what do we do now? We keep fighting is what we do. We had one bad witness, one fiasco. Every trial has a moment like this.
I pointed up to the TV. You a football fan, Jennifer? I knew she had gone to UC Santa Barbara for her undergraduate degree, then Southwestern. Not much in the way of collegiate football powers.
That's not football, that's basketball.
Yeah, I know, but do you like football?
I like the Raiders.
I knew it, Sisko said gleefully. A girl after my own heart.
Well, I said, when you're a defense lawyer, you have to be like a cornerback. You know you're going to get burned from time to time. It's just part of the game. So when it happens, you have to pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and forget about it, because they're about to snap the ball again. We gave them a touchdown today. I gave them a touchdown. But the game's not over, Jennifer. Not by a long shot.
Right, so what do we do?
What we've planned to do all along. Go after Aparicio. It comes down to him. I've got to push him to the edge. I think Sisko's given me the firepower to do it, and hopefully his guard will be down, because we've had Dahl telling him it's going to be a walk in the park. Realistically, right now, I think the score is tied. Even with Driscoll blowing up, I'd say we're either tied, or maybe the prosecution's got a few points up on us. I've got to change that tomorrow. If I don't, we lose. A somber silence followed until Aronson asked another question.
What about Driscoll, Mickey?
What about him? We're done with Driscoll.
Yeah, but did you believe him about all the software stuff? Do you think Aparicio's people set him up? Was all of that about him stealing software made up lies? Because now it's out in front of the media.
I don't know. Freeman did a smart thing. She coupled it with something he wouldn't or couldn't deny, stealing the test. So it all sort of flowed together. Anyway, it doesn't matter what I believe, it's what the jury believes.
I think you're wrong. I think what you believe is always important.
I nodded.
Maybe so, Jennifer.
I took a long sip of my anemic drink. Aronson then went in a new direction.
How come you stopped calling me Bullocks?
I looked at her, and then looked back at my drink. I shrugged. Because you did so well today. It's like you're all grown up or something, and you shouldn't be called by a nickname. I looked past her at Sisko and pointed. But him? With a name like Wojciechowski, he's got his nickname for life, and that's just the way it is. We all laughed, and it seemed to relieve some of the pressure. I knew alcohol could help with that, but it had been 2 years now, and I was strong. I wouldn't slip.
What did you tell Dahl to go back with today? Sisko asked.
I shrugged again. The defense is in disarray. They lost their best shot with Driscoll when Freeman destroyed him. Then the usual. We don't have anything on Aparicio, and testifying will be like cutting butter left out on the counter. He's supposed to call me after he talks to his handler. Sisko nodded. I continued in another direction.
I'm thinking Aparicio is the way to end it. If I can get what Sisko has gotten for me to the jury in questions and his answers, and I push him to the nickel, then I think I'll just end it there. And Sisko, you won't testify.
Aronson frowned, like she wasn't sure that would be a good move.
Good, Sisko said. I won't have to wear the monkey suit tomorrow.
He tugged at his collar like it was made of sandpaper. No, you have to wear it again, just in case. You have another shirt like that, don't you?
Not really. I guess I'll have to wash this tonight.
Are you kidding me? You only... Sisko made a low whistling sound and nodded toward the door behind me. I turned, just as Maggie McPherson slipped onto the open stool next to me.
There you are.
Maggie McPherson. She pointed to my drink.
That better not be what I think it is.
Don't worry, it's not.
Good.
She ordered a real vodka tonic from Randy the bartender, probably just to rub it in.
So, drowning your sorrows without the drown. I did hear it was a good day for the good guys.
Meaning the prosecution, always. Maybe. You hired a sitter for a Monday night?
No, the sitter offered to sit tonight. I take it when I can get it, because she's got a boyfriend now, so I've probably seen my last Friday and Saturday nights out on the town.
Okay, so you get her tonight, and you go out to the bar by yourself?
Maybe I was looking for you, Holler. Ever think of that?
I turned on my stool so my back was to Aronson, and I was directly facing Maggie.
Really? Maybe. I thought you could use some company. You're not answering your cell.
I forgot. It's still off from court.
I pulled the phone and turned it on. No wonder I hadn't gotten the call from Herb Dahl.
You want to go to your place? She asked. I looked at her for a long moment before answering. Tomorrow's going to be the most important day of the trial.
I have till midnight.
I took a deep breath, but more air went out than came in. I leaned toward her and then tilted so that our heads were touching. Sort of like how they touch sabers before a fencing match. I whispered in her ear, I can't keep doing things this way. We have to go forward or be done. She put her hand on my chest and pushed me back. I was afraid of what my life would be like with her completely gone from it. I regretted the ultimatum I had just set out because I knew that if forced to make a choice, she would pick the latter.
What do you say we just worry about tonight, Holler?
Okay, I said so quickly that we both started laughing. I had dodged a bullet I had fired at myself, for now. I still have to get some work done at some point.
Yeah, we'll see about that.
She reached to the bar for her drink, but took mine by mistake. Or maybe not by mistake. She sipped and then screwed up her face in disgust.
That tastes just awful without vodka. What's the point?
I know. Was that some sort of test?
No, just a mistake.
Sure. She drank from her own glass now. I turned slightly and looked back at Sisko and Aronson. They were leaning toward each other, engaged in a conversation and ignoring me. I turned back to Maggie.
Marry me again, Maggie. I'm going to change everything after this case.
I've heard that before, the second part.
Yeah, but this time it's going to happen. It already is.
Do I have to answer right now? Is it a one-time thing, or can I think about it?
Sure, take a few minutes. I'm going to hit the head, and then I'll be back.
We laughed again, and then I leaned forward and kissed her and held my face in her hair. I whispered again, I can't think of being with anybody else. She turned into me and kissed my neck, then pulled back.
I hate public displays of affection, especially in bars. Seems so cheap.
Sorry.
Let's go now.
She slid off the stool and took a last sip of her drink while standing. I pulled my cash and peeled off enough to cover everybody, including the bartender. I told Sisko and Aronson I was going.
I thought we were still talking about Aparizio, Aronson protested.
I saw Sisko surreptitiously touch her arm in a not-now signal. I appreciated that.
You know what? I said. It's been a long day. Sometimes not thinking about something is the best way to prepare for it.
I'll be in the office early tomorrow before going to court, if you want to come by. Otherwise, I'll see you in court at 9. We said our goodbyes, and I walked out with my ex-wife.
You want to leave a car here or what? I asked.
No, too dangerous to come back here after dinner and being in bed with you. I'll want to go in for one last drink, and then it might not be the last. I have the sitter to relieve and work tomorrow, too.
Is that how you view it? Just dinner and sex and getting home by midnight?
She could have really hurt me then. Said I was whining like a woman complaining about men. But she didn't.
No, she said. I actually view it as the best night of the week.
I raised my hand and clasped the back of her neck as we walked to our cars. She always liked that, even if it was a public display of affection.
Chapter 48. You could feel the tension rise with each step as Louis Aparizio made his way to the witness stand on Tuesday morning. He wore a light tan suit with a blue shirt and maroon tie. He looked dignified, in a way that bespoke money and power, and it was clear that he looked at me through contemptuous eyes. He was my witness, but obviously there was no love lost here. Since the start of the trial, I had pointed the finger of guilt at someone other than my client. I had pointed at Aparizio, and now he sat before me.
This was the main event, and as such it had drawn the biggest crowd, both media and onlookers, of the trial. I started things out cordially, but wasn't planning to continue that way. I had one goal here, and the verdict was riding on whether I achieved it. I had to push the man in the witness box to the limit. He was there only because he had been cornered by his own avarice and vanity. He had ignored legal counsel, declined to hide behind the Fifth Amendment, and accepted the challenge of going one-on-one with me in front of a packed house. My job was to make him regret those decisions. My job was to make him take the Fifth in front of the jury. If he did that, then Lisa Trammell would walk. There could be no stronger reasonable doubt than to have the straw man you've been pointing at all trial long hide behind the Fifth, to refuse to answer questions on the grounds that he would incriminate himself. How could any honest juror vote guilty beyond a reasonable doubt after that? Good morning, Mr. Aparicio. How are you?
I'd rather be somewhere else. How are you?
I smiled. He was feisty from the start. I'll tell you that in a few hours, I answered. Thank you for being here today. I noticed a bit of a northeastern accent. Are you not from Los Angeles?
I was born in Brooklyn 51 years ago. I moved out here for law school and never left.
You and your company have been mentioned here during the trial more than a few times. It seems to hold the lion's share of foreclosure work in at least this county.
I was...
Your Honor, Freeman interrupted from her seat. Is there going to be a question here? Perry looked down at her for a moment. Is that an objection, Miss Freeman? She realized she had not stood. The judge had instructed us in pre-trial meetings that we must stand to make an objection. She quickly stood up.
Yes, Your Honor.
Ask a question, Mr. Haller.
I was about to, Your Honor. Mr. Aparicio, could you tell us in your words what it is that Aloft does? Aparicio cleared his throat and turned directly toward the jurors when he answered. He was a polished and proficient witness. I had my work cut out for me.
I'd be happy to. Essentially, Aloft is a processing firm. Large loan servicers such as Westland National pay my company to handle property foreclosures from start to finish. We handle everything, from drawing up the paperwork, to serving notices, to appearing in court as necessary. All for one all-inclusive fee. Nobody likes to hear about foreclosures. We all struggle on some level to pay our bills, and to try to keep our homes. But sometimes it doesn't work out, and foreclosure is required. That's where we come in.
You say, but sometimes it doesn't work out. Over the past few years, it has been working out pretty good for you, though, hasn't it?
Our business has seen tremendous growth in the past 4 years, and it has only now finally started to level off.
You mentioned Westland National as a client. Westland was a significant client, correct?
It was, and still is.
About how many foreclosures do you handle for Westland in a year?
I wouldn't know off the top of my head. But I think it's safe to say that with all of their locations in the western United States, we get close to 10,000 files from them in a year.
Would you believe that over the past 4 years, you have averaged over 16,000 cases a year referred by Westland? It's in the bank's annual report. I held it up for all to see.
Yes, I would believe that. Annual reports don't lie.
What is the fee that Aloft charges per foreclosure?
On residential, we charge $2,500, and that's for everything, even if we have to go to court on the matter.
So, doing the math, your company takes in $40 million a year from Westland alone, correct?
If the figures you used are correct, that sounds right.
I take it, then, that the Westland account was very big at Aloft.
Yes, but all our clients are important.
So you must have known Mitchell Bondurant, the victim in this case, pretty well, correct?
Of course I knew him well, and I think it's a terrible shame about what happened to him. He was a good man, trying to do a good job.
I'm sure we all appreciate your sympathy. But at the time of his death, you weren't very happy with Mr. Bondurant, were you?
I'm not sure what you mean. We were business associates. We had minor disputes from time to time,
but that always happens in the natural course of business.
Well, I'm not talking about minor disputes or the natural course of business. I'm asking you about a letter Mr. Bondurant sent to you shortly before his murder that threatened to expose fraudulent practices within your company. The certified letter was signed for by your personal secretary. Did you read it?
I skimmed it. It indicated to me that one of my 185 employees had taken a shortcut. This was a minor dispute, and nothing about it was threatening, as you say. I told the person who had that particular file to fix it. That's all, Mr. Holler.
But that wasn't all I had to say about the letter. I made Aparicio read it to the jury, and for the next half hour, I asked increasingly specific and uncomfortable questions about its allegations. I then moved on to the federal target letter and made the witness read that as well. But again, Aparicio was unflappable, dismissing the federal letter as a shot in the dark.
"I welcomed them with open arms," he said. "But you know what? Nobody's come in. All this time later, and not a word from Mr. Lattimore or Agent Vasquez or any other federal agent. Because their letter didn't pay off. I didn't run, I didn't sweat, I didn't cry foul or hide behind a lawyer. I said, 'I know you've got a job to do. Come on in and check us out. Our doors are open and we've got absolutely nothing to hide.'"
It was a good and well-rehearsed answer, and Aparicio was clearly winning the early rounds. But that was okay, because I was saving my best punches. I wanted him to feel confident and in control. Through Herb Dahl, he had been fed a steady diet of no worries. He had been led to believe I had nothing but a few desperate hints of conspiracy that he could easily swat away as he was doing right now. His confidence was growing. But when he got too confident and complacent, I was going to move in and go for the knockout. This fight wouldn't go 15 rounds. It couldn't. Now, at the time these letters were coming in, you were engaged in a secret negotiation, were you not? Aparicio paused for the first time since I'd begun asking him questions.
I was engaged at the time in private business discussions, as I am at almost all times. I would not use the word secret because of the connotation. Secrecy being wrong, when in fact keeping one's business private, is a matter of course.
Okay, then this private discussion was actually a negotiation to sell your company Aloft to a publicly traded company, correct?
Yes, that is so.
A company called Lemur.
Yes, correct.
This deal would be worth a lot of money to you, would it not? Freeman stood and asked for a sidebar. We approached and she stated her objection in a forceful whisper. How is this relevant? Where are we going with this? He now has us on Wall Street, and that has nothing to do with Lisa Trammell and the evidence against her. Your Honor, I said quickly before he could cut me off, the relevance will become apparent soon. Ms. Freeman knows exactly where this is headed, and she just doesn't want to go there. But the court has given me the latitude to put forth a defense involving third-party guilt. Well, this is it, Judge. This is where it comes together, and so I ask for the court's continued indulgence. Perry didn't have to think too long before answering. Mr. Holler, you may proceed, but I want you to land this plane soon. Thank you, Judge. We returned to our positions, and I decided to move things along at a quicker pace. Mr. Aparicio, back in January, when you were in the midst of these negotiations with Lemur, you knew you stood to make a great deal of money if this deal went through, did you not?
I would be generously compensated for the years I spent growing the company.
But if you lost one of your biggest clients, to the tune of $40 million in annual revenues, that deal would have been in peril, correct?
There was no threat from any client to leave.
I draw your attention back to the letter Mr. Bondurant sent you, sir. Wouldn't you say that there is a clear threat from Mr. Bondurant to take Westland's business away from you? I believe you still have a copy of the letter there in front of you, if you want to refer to it.
I don't need to look at the letter. There was no threat to me whatsoever. Mitch sent me the letter, and I took care of the problem.
Like the way you took care of Donald Driscoll.
Objection, Freeman said. Argumentative.
I'll withdraw it. Mr. Aparicio, you received this letter smack dab in the middle of your deal-making with Lemur, correct?
It was during negotiations, yes.
And at the time you received this letter from Mr. Bondurant, you knew he was in financial straits himself, correct?
I knew nothing about Mr. Bondurant's personal financial situation.
Did you not have an employee of your company do financial background searches on Mr. Bondurant and other bankers you dealt with?
No. That's ridiculous. Whoever said that is a liar.
It was time for me to test Herb Dahl's work as a double agent. At the time Mr. Bondurant sent you that letter, was he aware of your secret dealings with Lemur? Aparicio's answer should have been, I don't know. But I had told Dahl to send back word through his handler that the Trammell legal team had found nothing on this key part of the defense strategy.
He knew nothing about it, Aparicio said. I had kept all of our client banks in the dark while negotiations were ongoing.
Who is Lemur's chief financial officer? Aparicio seemed momentarily nonplussed by the question and the seeming change in direction.
That would be Sid Jenkins, Sidney Jenkins.
And was he the leader of the acquisition team you dealt with on the Lemur deal? Freeman objected and asked where this was going. I told the judge he would know shortly, and he allowed me to continue, telling Aparicio to answer the question.
Yes, I dealt with Sid Jenkins on the acquisition.
I opened a file and removed a document while asking the judge for permission to approach the witness with it. As expected, Freeman objected and we had a spirited sidebar over the admissibility of the document. But just as Freeman had won the battle over presenting Driscoll with the internal investigation report from Aloft, Judge Perry evened the score, allowing me to introduce the document subject to his later ruling. Permission granted, I handed a copy to the witness. Mr. Aparicio, can you tell the jury what that document is?
I can't tell for sure.
Is it not a printout from a digital daybook?
If you say so.
And what name is on the top of the sheet there?
Mitchell Bondurant.
And what is the date on the page?
December 13th.
Can you read the appointment entry for 10 o'clock? Freeman asked for a sidebar, and once more we stood in front of the judge. Your Honor, Lisa Trammell is on trial here, not Louis Aparicio or Mitchell Bondurant. This is what happens when someone takes advantage of the court's goodwill when given leeway. I object to this line of questioning. Counsel is taking us far afield of the matter this jury must decide. Judge, I said, again this goes to third-party guilt. This is a page from the digital diary turned over to the defense in discovery. The answer to this question will make it clear to the jury that the victim in this case was involved in subtly extorting the witness. And that is a motive for murder.
Judge, this...
That's enough, Ms. Freeman.
I will allow it. We returned to our places, and the judge told Aparicio to answer the question. I repeated it for the sake of the jury. What is listed on Mr. Bondurant's calendar for 10 o'clock on December 13th?
It says Sidney Jenkins, Lemur.
So would you not take from that log line that Mr. Bondurant became aware of the Aloft Lemur deal in December of last year?
I couldn't begin to know what was said at that meeting, or if it even took place.
What reason would the man leading the acquisition of Aloft have for meeting with one of Aloft's most important bank clients?
You would have to ask Mr. Jenkins that.
Perhaps I will. Aparicio had developed a scowl in the course of the questioning. The Herb Dahl plant had worked well. I moved on. When did the deal on the sale of Aloft to Lemur close?
The deal closed in late February.
How much was it sold for?
I'd rather not say.
Lemur is a publicly traded company, sir. The information is out there. Could you save us the time and...
$96 million.
Most of which, as sole owner, went to you, correct?
A good portion of it,
Yes.
And you got stock in Lemur as well, correct?
That's right.
And you remain president of Aloft, don't you?
Yes, I still run the company. I just have bosses now.
He tried a smile, but most of the working stiffs in the courtroom didn't see the humor in the comment, considering the millions he had taken out of the deal.
So you are still intimately involved in the day-to-day operations of the company?
Yes, sir, I am.
Mr. Aparicio, was your personal take in the sale of Aloft $61 million, as reported by the Wall Street Journal?
They got that wrong.
How so?
My deal was worth that amount, but it didn't come to me all at once.
You got deferred payments.
Something along those lines. But I don't really see what this has to do with who killed Mitch Bondurant, Mr. Holler. Why am I here? I had nothing to...
Your Honor? Hold on a moment, Mr. Aparicio, the judge said. He then leaned forward over the bench and paused as if to contemplate something. We're going to take our morning break now, and counsel will join me in chambers. The court is in recess. Once more, we followed the judge back into chambers. Once more, I was going to be the one put on the spot. But I was so angry at Perry that I went on the offensive. I stayed standing while both he and Freeman took seats. Your Honor, with all due respect, I had a certain momentum going out there, and taking the morning break early is killing it. Mr. Holler, you may have had plenty of momentum, but it was taking you far away from this case. I have bent over backward to allow you to present a third-party defense, but I am beginning to feel I've been had. Judge, I was four questions away from bringing it all back home to this case, but you just stopped me. You stopped yourself, counsel. I can't sit up there and let this go on. Ms. Freeman's been objecting, now even the witness is objecting. And I'm looking like a fool. You're fishing. You told me, and you told those jurors, that you would not only prove that your client didn't commit the crime, but that you would prove who did. But we are now five witnesses into the defense case, and you are still fishing. Your Honor, I can't believe... Look, I am not fishing here. I am proving. Bondurant had threatened to cost that man out there $61 million. It is obvious, and anyone with common sense sees this. And if that is not motive for a murder, then I guess I...
Motive isn't proof, Freeman said. It's not evidence, and you obviously don't have any. The defense's whole case is a charade. What's next? You name everybody Bondurant was foreclosing on as a suspect?
I pointed down at her in the chair. That wouldn't be a bad idea, but the fact is, the defense case is not a charade, and if allowed to continue my examination of the witness, I will get to the evidence very quickly. Sit down, Mr. Holler, and please watch your tone when you are addressing me.
Yes, Your Honor. I apologize.
I sat down and waited while Perry brooded over the situation. Finally, he spoke. Ms. Freeman, anything else?
I think the court is well aware of how the prosecution views what Mr. Holler has been allowed to do. I warned early and often that he would create a sideshow that had nothing to do with the case at hand. We are well past that point now, and I have to agree with the court's assessment that all of this makes the court look foolish and manipulated.
She had gone too far. I could see the skin around Perry's eyes tighten as she stated that he looked like a fool. I think she'd had him in her hand, but then lost him.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Freeman.
I think at this time, I'm inclined to go back out and give Mr. Holler one final chance to tie it all in. Do you understand what I mean by final chance, Mr. Holler?
Yes, Your Honor. I will comply.
You'd better, sir, because the court's patience has drawn thin. Let's go back now.
Out at the defense table, I saw Aronson waiting by herself and realized she hadn't followed me into chambers. I sat down wearily.
Where's Lisa?
In the hallway with Dahl. What happened?
I've got one more chance. I have to move things up and go in for the kill now.
Can you do it?
We'll see.
I've got to run out to the facilities before we start again. Why didn't you come into chambers?
No one asked me to, and I didn't know if I should just follow you in.
Next time, follow me in.
Courthouse designs are good at separating parties. Jurors have their own assembly and deliberation rooms, and there are aisles and gates to separate opposing parties and supporters. But the restrooms are the great equalizers. You step into one of these, and you never know who you will encounter. I pushed through the inner door of the men's room and almost walked right into Aparicio, who was washing his hands at the sink. He was bent over and looked up at me in the mirror.
"Well, counselor, did the judge slap your hands a little bit?"
"That's none of your business. I'll find another restroom." I turned around to leave, but Aparicio stopped me.
"Don't bother. I'm leaving."
He shook his wet hands off and moved toward the door, coming very close to me and then suddenly stopping.
"You are despicable, Holler," he said. "Your client is a murderer, and you have the balls to try to cast the blame on me. How do you look at yourself in the mirror?"
He turned and gestured toward the line of urinals.
"This is where you belong," he said, "in the toilet."
Chapter 49. It all came down to the next half hour, maybe an hour at the most. I sat at the defense table, composing my thoughts and waiting. Everyone was in their places except for the judge, who remained in chambers, and Aparicio, who was smugly conferring with his two attorneys in the front row of the gallery, where they had reserved seats. My client leaned toward me and whispered, so that not even Aronson could hear.
"You have more, right?"
"Excuse me?"
"You have more, don't you, Mickey? More to go after him with."
Even she knew that what I had already trotted out was not enough. I whispered back, "We'll know before lunch. We'll either be drinking champagne or crying in our soup." The door to the judge's chambers opened and Perry emerged. He called for the jury and the witness to return to the stand before he was even seated on the bench. A few minutes later, I was back at the lectern staring down Aparicio. The restroom confrontation seemed to give him renewed confidence. He adopted a relaxed posture that announced to the world that he was home free. I decided that there was no sense in waiting. It was time to start swinging. "Now then, Mr. Aparicio, continuing our discussion from before, you have not been completely truthful in your testimony today, have you?"
"I've been completely honest, and I resent the question."
"You lied from the start, didn't you, sir? Giving a false name when sworn by the clerk."
"My name was legally changed 31 years ago. I did not lie, and it has nothing to do with this."
"What is the name that is on your birth certificate?" Aparicio paused, and I think I saw the first inkling or recognition of where I was going with this.
"My birth name was Antonio Luigi Aparicio, like now but spelled with an A. Growing up, people called me Lou or Louie because there were a lot of Anthonys and Antonios in the neighborhood. I decided to go with Louis. I legally changed my name to Anthony Louis Aparicio. I Americanized it. That's it."
"But why did you change the spelling of your last name, too?"
"There was a professional baseball player at the time named Luis Aparicio. I thought the names were too close. Louis Aparicio and Luis Aparicio. I didn't want to have a name so close to a famous person's. So I changed the spelling. Is that okay with you, Mr. Holler?"
The judge admonished Aparicio to simply answer the questions and not ask them. "Do you know when Luis Aparicio retired from professional baseball?" I asked. I glanced at the judge after asking the question. If his patience was being stretched before, it was now probably as thin as the piece of paper a contempt citation would be printed on.
"No, I don't know when he retired."
"Does it surprise you to learn it was 8 years before you changed your name?"
"No, it doesn't surprise me."
"But you expect the jury to believe that you changed your name to avoid a match to a baseball player long out of the game?" Aparicio shrugged.
"It's what happened."
"Isn't it true that you changed your name from Aparicio to Aparicio
because you were an ambitious young man and wanted to at least outwardly distance yourself from your family.
No, untrue. I did want to have a more American-sounding name, but I wasn't distancing myself from anyone.
I saw Aparicio's eyes make a quick dart in the direction of his attorney's.
You were originally named after your uncle, were you not? I asked.
No, that's not true, Aparicio answered quickly. I wasn't named after anyone.
You had an uncle named Antonio Luigi Aparicio, the same name as on your birth certificate. And are you saying it was just coincidence?
Realizing his mistake in lying, Aparicio tried to recover, but only made it worse.
My parents never told me who I was named after, or even if I was named after someone.
And a bright person like you didn't put it together?
I never thought about it. When I was 21, I came west and was not close to my family anymore.
You mean geographically?
In any way, I started a new life. I stayed out here.
Your father and your uncle were involved in organized crime, were they not?
Freeman quickly objected and asked for a sidebar.
When we got there, she did everything but roll her eyes back into her head as she tried to communicate her frustration.
Your Honor, enough is enough. Counsel may show no shame in besmirching the reputations of his own witnesses, but this has to end. This is a trial, Judge, not a deep-sea fishing trip.
Your Honor, you told me to move quickly, and that is what I am doing. I have an offer of proof that clearly shows this is no fishing trip.
Well, what is it, Mr. Holler?
I handed the judge a thick-bound document I had carried to the sidebar. There were several post-its of different colors protruding from its pages. That is the U.S. Attorney General's Report to Congress on Organized Crime. It's dated 1986, and the AG at the time was Edwin Meese. If you go to the yellow post-it and open the page, the highlighted paragraph is my offer of proof.
The judge read the passage and then turned the book around so Freeman could read it.
Before she was finished, he ruled on the objection.
Ask your questions, Mr. Holler, but I'm giving you about 10 minutes to connect the dots. If you don't do it by then, I'm going to shut you down.
Thank you, Judge. I went back to the lectern and asked the question again, but in a different way.
Mr. Aparicio, were you aware that your father and your uncle were members of an organized crime group known as the Gambino family?
Aparicio had seen me offer the bound book to the judge. He knew I had something to back my question. Rather than throw out a full denial, he went with a vague response. As I said, I left my family behind when I went off to school. I didn't know about them after that, and I was told nothing before.
It was time to be relentless, to back Aparicio to the edge of the cliff.
Wasn't your uncle, known as Anthony the Ape Aparicio, because of his reputation for brutality and violence?
I wouldn't know.
Didn't your uncle act as a father figure in your life while your own father spent most of your teenage years in prison for extortion?
My uncle took care of us financially, but he was not a father figure.
When you moved out west at age 21, was it to distance yourself from your family or to extend your family's business opportunities to the West Coast?
Now that's a lie. I came out here for law school. I had nothing and brought nothing with me, including family connections.
Are you familiar with the term sleeper, as it is applied in organized crime investigations?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Would it surprise you to learn that the FBI, starting in the 1980s, believed that the mob was attempting to move into legitimate areas of business by sending its next generation of members to schools and other locales so that they could sink roots and start businesses, and that these people were called sleepers?
I am a legitimate businessman. No one sent me anywhere, and I put myself through law school working for a process server.
I nodded, as though I expected the answer. Speaking of process servers, you own several companies, don't you, sir?
I don't understand.
Let me rephrase. When you sold Aloft to the Lemur Fund,
You kept ownership of a variety of companies that contracted with Aloft, correct?
Aparicio took his time thinking about an answer. He made another furtive glance toward his attorneys. It was a get-me-out-of-this look. He knew where I was going, and he knew I couldn't be allowed to get there. But he was on the witness stand, and there was only one way out.
I have ownership and part ownership in a variety of different enterprises. All of them legal, all of them above board and legitimate.
It was a good answer, but it was not going to be good enough.
What kind of companies? What services do they provide?
You mentioned process serving. That's one of them. I have a paralegal referral and placement company. There's an office staffing company and an office furniture supply entity. Do you own a courier service?
The witness paused before answering. He was trying to think two questions ahead, and I wasn't staying in a rhythm he could pick up on.
I'm an investor. I'm not the sole owner.
Let's talk about the courier service. First of all, what's it called?
Wingnut's Courier Service.
And is that a Los Angeles-based company?
Based here, but with offices in 7 cities. It operates all over this state and Nevada.
Exactly how much of Wingnut's do you own?
I am a partial participant. I believe I own 40% of it.
And who are some of the other participants?
Well, there are several. Some aren't people, they're other companies.
Like AA Best Consultants of Brooklyn, New York, which is listed on corporate records in Sacramento as part owner of Wings?
Aparicio was again slow to answer. This time, he seemed lost in a dark thought until the judge prompted him.
Yes, I believe that is one of the investors.
Now, corporation documents held by the state of New York show that the majority owner of AA Best is one Dominic Capelli? Are you familiar with him?
No, I am not.
You are saying that you are unfamiliar with one of your partners in Wingnut's, sir?
AA Best invested. I invested. I don't know all the individuals involved.
Freeman stood. It was about time. I had been waiting for her to object for at least 4 questions. I was spinning my wheels waiting.
Your Honor, is there a point to all of this? She asked.
I was beginning to wonder about that myself, Perry said. You want to enlighten us, Mr. Haller?
3 more questions, Your Honor, and I think the relevance here will be crystal clear to everyone, I said. I beg the court's indulgence for just 3 more questions.
I had stared at Aparicio the whole time I'd said it. I was sending the message. Pull the plug now, or your secrets will be put out there in the world. Lemur will know. Your stockholders will know. The U.S. Attorney's Office will know. Everyone will know.
Very well, Mr. Haller. Thank you, Your Honor.
I looked down at my notes. Now was the time. If I had Aparicio right, now was the time. I looked back at him.
Mr. Aparicio, would it surprise you to learn that Dominic Capelli, the partner you claim not to know, is listed by the New York...
Your Honor?
It was Aparicio. He had cut me off.
On advice of counsel, and pursuant to my 5th Amendment rights and privileges granted by the Constitution of the United States and the State of California, I respectfully decline to answer this or further questions.
There. I stood totally still. But that was only on the outside. Energy flooded through me like a scream. I was barely aware of the rumble of whispers that went through the courtroom. Then from behind me, a voice firmly addressed the court.
Your Honor, may I address the court, please?
I turned and saw it was one of Aparicio's attorneys, Martin Zimmer. Then I heard Freeman, her voice high and tight, calling an objection and asking for a sidebar. But I knew a sidebar wasn't going to do it this time. And so did Perry.
Mr. Zimmer, you may sit down. We are going to break now for lunch, and I expect all parties to be back in court at 1 o'clock this afternoon. The jury, is directed not to discuss the case with one another or to draw any conclusions from the testimony and request of this witness.
Court broke loudly after that, with the members of the media talking among themselves. As the last juror was going through the door, I stepped away from the lectern and leaned down to the defense table to whisper in Aronson's ear, "You might want to come back to chambers this time." She was about to ask what I meant when Perry made it official.
"I want counsel to join me in chambers, immediately. Mr. Aparicio, I want you to stay right there. You can consult with your counsel, but don't leave the courtroom."
With that, the judge got up and headed back. I followed. Chapter 50. By now, I was intimately getting to know the wall hangings and furnishings and everything else in the judge's chambers. But I expected that this would be my last visit, and probably the most difficult. As we entered, the judge stripped off his robe and threw it haphazardly over the hat rack in the corner, rather than carefully put it on a hanger as he had on prior in-camera meetings. He then dropped into his seat and loudly exhaled. He leaned far back and looked up at the ceiling. He had a petulant look on his face, as though his concerns over what would be decided here were more about his own reputation as a jurist than about justice for a murder victim.
"Mr. Haller," he said, as though he was releasing a great burden.
"Yes, Your Honor,"
the judge rubbed his face. "Please tell me that it was not your plan all along, and from the beginning, to force Mr. Aparicio into taking the Fifth in front of the jury."
"Judge," I said, "I had no idea he was going to take the Fifth. After the motion to quash hearing we had, I thought there was no way he would. I was pushing him, sure, but I wanted the answers to my questions."
Freeman shook her head.
"You have something to add, Ms. Freeman."
"Your Honor, I think defense counsel has treated the court and the justice system with nothing but contempt from the start of this trial. He didn't even answer your question just now. He didn't say it wasn't his plan, Your Honor. He just said he had no idea. Those are two separate things, and they underline the fact that defense counsel is sneaky and has tried to sabotage this trial from the start. He has now succeeded. All along, Aparicio was a fifth witness, a straw man he could set up in front of the jury and then knock down when he took the Fifth. That was the plan, and if that is not a subverting of the adversarial system, then I don't know what is."
I glanced at Aronson. She looked mortified, and maybe even swayed by Freeman's statement.
"Judge," I said calmly, "I can only say one thing to Ms. Freeman.
Prove it. If she's so sure this was some kind of master plan, then she can try to prove it. The truth is, and my young idealistic colleague here can back me on this, we did not even become aware of Aparicio's organized crime connections until just recently. My investigator literally stumbled across them while tracking back all of Aparicio's holdings as listed in his SEC filings. The police and prosecution had the opportunity to do this, but either chose to ignore it or came up short of the mark. I think counsel's upset largely extends from that, not what tactics I employ in court."
The judge, who was still leaning back and looking at the ceiling, made a waving gesture with his hand. I didn't know what it meant.
"Judge?"
Perry swung the chair around and leaned forward, addressing all three of us.
"So what do we do about this?"
He looked at me first. I glanced at Aronson to see if she had something to offer, but she looked frozen in place. I turned back to the judge.
"I don't think there is anything that can be done. The witness invoked the Fifth. He's done testifying. We can't go on with him selectively using the Fifth whenever or wherever he wants. He's invoked. He's done. Next witness."
"I have one more, and then I'm done too. I'll be ready to give my closing tomorrow morning." Freeman could no longer take it sitting down. She stood up and started pacing a short pattern near the window.
This is so unfair and so much a part of Mr. Haller's plan. He brings out the testimony he wants on direct, then pushes Aparicio into the fifth, and then the state gets no cross, no redress at all. Is that even remotely fair, Your Honor?
Perry didn't answer. He didn't have to. Everybody in the room knew the situation was